Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is May 28, 1977, and this is my monthly audio letter number 24. This issue concludes the second year of the audio letter. But only if we are blessed by a true miracle will the third year ever be completed. Because as I speak to you today, a tragedy has already been set in motion that is beyond human comprehension. Not since last July and August 1976, when the Soviet Union began planting underwater bombs and missiles in our own territorial waters, has the situation been so grave and urgent as it is now. For that reason, I will dispense with any further introduction today in order to discuss these three topics. Topic number one, the fall of Babylon revisited. Topic number two, the handwriting on the wall for America. And topic number three, water, the ultimate weapon. Topic number one, we live today in a world that grows more complex and more confusing with each passing day. But in spite of that, we Americans are fond of praising ourselves for the great man-made wonders of our age. And whenever the obvious dangers to our continued existence as a nation prey on our minds, we are always reminded that we, the great United States, have already survived fully two centuries since our republic was founded. And scarcely a day goes by that we are not reassured by our rulers, elected and otherwise, that we are the mightiest nation on earth. Our technology, we are told day in and day out, is so wonderful that it is impossible that any other nation on earth, especially the poor, backward Soviet Union, might surpass us in any important way. In other words, we are technologically impregnable. Unless we become prematurely concerned over the impact of the recent radical changes in our weather, certain news reports recently have told incredible lies to the effect that the United States has a 2-year surplus of grains in our storage bins. In all of this, the behavior of the United States today is like that of countless civilizations before us, just before they perished. And in some respects, the greatest similarity of all is with that of ancient Babylon, just before its abrupt fall from power. The origins of the United States, unlike Babylon, were strongly moral and spiritual in content. And the system of government set forth in the United States Constitution, which freed men in a way unparalleled in human history, was conceived by men who understood man's place within God's creation. This heritage still lives today in the hearts of many Americans, but it's rapidly being snuffed out under the bondage of rulers who are superimposing the pattern of ancient Babylon on our beloved land. The Babylonian pattern is totally evil, and those who choose to bow down to such satanic rule thereby make themselves part of it. The origins of ancient Babylon are lost in the midst of time, perhaps 5,000 years ago, but it reached its peak around 600 B.C., at which time it was undisputed as the most powerful empire the world had ever seen. The city of Babylon was the Rome of its day, the most important trading center, the most powerful military force, the greatest cultural influence, and even a center of tourism because of its remarkable hanging gardens and other man-made wonders. The huge city of Babylon was surrounded by city walls so high and so thick that they were impregnable by any military technology of that day. And inside the city, there was a 2-year supply of food. making any attempted siege against Babylon unattractive. And there was no lack of water either, because no less than the mighty river Euphrates ran through the city. Yes, Babylon was powerful, wealthy, and so secure in material terms that potential adversaries were hardly even taken seriously. Even when it became clear that the increasingly powerful joint empire of the Medes and the Persians had designs on Babylon, there was no real concern. With all their means of protection against invasion and their unrivaled prosperity, the Babylonian attitude was simply, it couldn't happen here. And so when the Medo-Persian army of Cyrus and Darius laid siege to Babylon, the only response of the ruler of Babylon was debauchery, feasting, drunkenness, and mocking any real power greater than himself. At this point, we're told, the Babylonian feast was interrupted by the appearance of a hand in midair, writing words on the wall that said Babylon's rule was at an end, that its ruler had been weighed in the balances and found wanting, and that the kingdom would be divided and given to the Medes and Persians. The handwriting on the wall said the impossible was about to happen. Babylon, the impregnable city, was about to fall. How could this be? No one in Babylon had ever had experience with invasion, and so could not imagine such a thing. And yet, within a few short hours, before the drunken feast even ended, the impossible happened. First, the water level in the mighty Euphrates River, flowing through the middle of Babylon, started dropping rapidly. It dwindled to a trickle and soon stopped altogether. Cyrus the Persian had worked out of sight of Babylon and had diverted the Euphrates out of its normal channel. Now the great impregnable walls of Babylon were left with huge openings, namely the riverbed no longer filled with water. And in marched the Medo-Persian army, conquering Babylon without resistance. Today, the United States is under siege by the Soviet Union with the cooperation from within of Quislings. We are threatened by the joint Rockefeller-Soviet Empire, just as Babylon was besieged by the joint Medo-Persian Empire. And now as then, we are told there is nothing to worry about. It just couldn't happen here. But, my friends, just as happened in ancient Babylon, the handwriting is now on the wall for America. The America we know today is a perversion of the pattern originally laid down for our beloved land. And America, as we know it, is about to come to an end. And as with ancient Babylon, water is our Achilles' heel, and the means by which we are to be reduced to surrender without a fight. Topic number two. Not long ago, the Carter administration's ambassador to the United Nations, Andy Young, made the remarkable statement that, quote, communism has never been a threat to me, unquote. He also has a habit of patting Cuba on the back for the so-called stabilizing influence of Cuban troops in Africa, and otherwise has repeatedly shown a very amiable attitude toward world communism. Many Americans have wondered why Andy Young is allowed to go on saying such things without being restrained in any way by Jimmy Carter. But Carter has now answered that in a major foreign policy speech given at the University of Notre Dame on May 22, 1977. This speech is as important as the famous Iron Curtain speech of Sir Winston Churchill a generation ago at Fulton, Missouri. White House aides stated that the Carter speech at Notre Dame was specifically intended to, quote, send some messages to foreign governments, unquote. And it did. The foreign press is filled with headlines about the major turn that has just been taken in American foreign policy. Yet here at home, many Americans have not grasped what has happened. The most basic theme of that Carter speech is an elaborate echo of Andy Young's statement. That is, we are no longer afraid of communism. Is this because communism is withering and dying? One need only look at a map to see how fast communism is eating up the world. But Jimmy Carter is telling us, and the world is, we can get along with communism. And just to prove it, one of America's most important efficient intelligence operations to keep an eye on Soviet naval movements and other important matters is being closed down. This intelligence unit, known as Task Force 157 and run by the United States Navy, has a budget of well under 0.1% of that of the CIA, and yet it is being shut down, supposedly for budgetary reason. Meanwhile, the signs of war to come are all around us. So great are the dangers facing us that military men are speaking up in increasing numbers in an effort to warn America before disaster arrives. Since they are subject to military law and subordinate to civilians who do not want them to speak up, it's no small thing to speak out in this way. So, consider what Major General John K. Singlob said in an interview on May 19, 1977. General Singlob, the third-ranking United States Army general in Korea, said, quote, "If we withdraw our ground forces on the schedule suggested, it will lead to war," unquote. And why did General Singlob speak up? His answer was, quote, "The question asked after United States setbacks in Korea and Vietnam was, did the military people in the know express themselves loudly and clearly enough that the decision makers understood? We want to make sure," unquote. In speaking this way, General Singlob was doing no more than expressing the consensus of practically every knowledgeable military man about the Korean situation. For example, the same Washington Post article that quoted General Singlob also quoted another headquarters Army officer in Korea as saying about the Carter plan to withdraw our troops, quote, "I don't know anybody who is not staggered by it. There's no military or strategic logic for withdrawal," unquote. The plan to withdraw from South Korea, in other words, is strictly political, in line with the newly announced American foreign policy that it is no longer afraid of communism. The reason General Singlob's words had such an impact in this country is that his name was attached to his warnings. The words I just quoted from the other anonymous Army officer is just as startling as what General Singlob said. But people will just read those words once, frown, and then forget about it. But everyone knows about General Singlob's warnings because, deliberately or otherwise, he allowed himself to be identified as the source of the warnings. And for daring to warn us, he was promptly relieved of his Korean command by Jimmy Carter. The situation in Korea illustrates the direction in which events are now moving. But other events are due to occur long before the pullout of our troops from South Korea. The real threat to our security is no longer in Korea or in Europe, but right here in our own backyard. Another military man who is actively trying to warn America is Major General George Keegan, who retired at the beginning of this year as Chief of Air Force Intelligence. General Keegan is one of the West's greatest intelligence analysts, and the story he has to tell should be continuous headline news throughout our nation. General Keegan has been speaking on radio and television talk shows, giving speeches, accepting interviews, in short, using every channel open to him in an effort to wake up America before it is too late. One of his most comprehensive and important speeches was the one delivered on March 11, 1977 at a press conference sponsored by the American Security Council here in Washington, D.C. To find out in more detail what General Keegan had to say, I would urge every American to obtain a copy of that speech. Write to the American Security Council, Boston, Virginia, 22713 for information. It was published as the April 1977 Washington Report of the American Security Council. We're frequently told by syndicated columnists that the CIA is our first line of defense. But General Keegan said in his speech, quote, "The ultimate function of a nation's intelligence is to render carefully assessed judgments and forecasts regarding the threat." When I look back upon my experience with this nation's highest estimating body, I have the impression of having taken part in a Charles Dickens novel. The sense of make-believe and unreality has to be experienced to be believed, unquote. Further on, he says, quote, "The intelligence estimators, heavily dominated by the CIA and the State Department, have been wrong about Soviet purposes in pursuing detente. They have been shockingly deficient in their estimates of the risks and the advantages to the United States and the free world of the so-called technology exchange with the Soviet Union," unquote. And he adds, quote, "If there has been a Watergate in this country, and there has been, but ignored, it has been in the monumentally incompetent judgmental processes of this government regarding the nature, character, and growth of the Soviet threat as it has evolved from year to year," unquote. General Keegan goes on to make crystal clear that the deficiencies in our intelligence estimates are not due to any lack of our ability to collect information or to analyze it technically. The problem instead has to do with what is done with that information. To begin with, the intelligence estimation process at the highest levels in America today is not objective, but is manipulated to fit political purposes. In General Keegan's words, and I quote, "The United States intelligence estimative process cannot be understood unless it is first appreciated that national intelligence estimates must perform three functions. First, they must support the decisions of the president, both for the record of history and for the avoidance of impeachment. Second, they must substantiate or help to justify the decisions of the White House Office of Management and Budget. Finally, the intelligence estimates must, whatever other purpose they may serve, rationalize the foreign security policy initiatives of the Secretary of State," unquote. Continuing, General Keegan says, quote, "I appreciate that those are extremely important allegations to make. But I submit to you today that it is not possible to understand the workings of the United States intelligence community unless one is willing to open his mind to the influence of those three factors," unquote. This situation is illustrated vividly by General Keegan's discussion of the controversy over the Soviet backfire bomber. As I've told you for many months, the supersonic backfire is an intercontinental strategic bomber capable of striking the United States with nuclear weapons. General Keegan says, quote, "The central issue all along has been whether this bomber posed a threat to the United States. The Soviets argued that it did not, and the CIA and State Department rather consistently accepted the Soviet point of view," unquote. General Keegan proceeded to acquire analysis of the backfire's capability from, quote, "the most competent analysts in the free world," unquote. The available intelligence information was provided to three American aircraft companies with experience building strategic bombers, plus, for good measure, the Royal Air Force and the Royal Aircraft Establishment in England. And the results, quote, "Every single one of these organizations independently agreed that the backfire had an intercontinental capability. Yet my word was not good enough, nor was that of the American and British heavy bomber designers and builders. CIA and State chose to believe the Soviets," unquote. General Keegan is not in a position to express it this way, my friends, but his description of the backfire controversy illustrates what I've been trying to tell you over the months, that the Rockefeller cartel has more faith in the Soviet Union than in our own United States. Finally, General Keegan explains, the sheer weight of analysis made it more and more apparent that the backfire was truly intercontinental. Quote, however, CIA and state now judged that the Soviet Union had no intention of using the backfire as an intercontinental bomber, unquote. This in spite of the fact that the second model of the backfire has been given even greater range. The history of the backfire controversy up to this point is very disgraceful and still generally unknown to the American people. But listen now to the final chapter in General Keegan's words, and I quote, seemingly undaunted by the most extensive analysis of a foreign bomber ever performed in the United States, the CIA, in one final super-secret, uncoordinated effort, proceeded over a period of 18 months to undertake an analysis designed to prove that the backfire bomber could not reach the United States. This effort, in which small bits and pieces of controlled information were provided to McDonnell Douglas Aircraft, designer and builder of fighters, represents one of the most artful contrivances I have ever observed. It is one which I suspect may have been designed to salvage a SALT accord. Finally, when the CIA surprised everyone by surfacing its new analysis, months of painful and extensive analysis were required to show that the books had been rigged. Artificially high G loadings had been assigned to the design of the backfire, along with excessive engine drag and other factors which were designed to reduce range, unquote. And this, my friends, is how our so-called first line of defense, the CIA, looks after America's national security to the tune of over $20 billion a year. Elsewhere in his talk, General Keegan also spells out the dangerous manner in which our military intelligence capabilities have been progressively over-centralized, compartmentalized, and taken over by civilians, quote, who understand little about the horrors of war. And these are people who understand even less about military doctrine, strategy, and weapons, unquote. The product of all these trends described by General Keegan is the very intelligence gap that I discussed with General George S. Brown, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when I met with him last September. For years, General Keegan has tried in vain to obtain a series of postmortem audits on the predictive and estimative record of the United States intelligence community. The audit would be performed by qualified but disinterested outsiders, with no links to the intelligence community, so that their work would be unbiased. Quoting General Keegan again, such audits would record scrupulously where we had been wrong, where we had been right, where we had fallen short of the mark, or where we had exaggerated. Yet, every such suggestion had been met with disdain and has been resisted in the most resounding, vocal, and emotional way, unquote. He might as well have asked for an honest audit of Fort Knox. General Keegan's speech contains many more things than there is time to discuss in this tape, and they're all important. He reveals many things about the military capabilities of both the Soviet Union and the United States that you will never hear through the usual news channels, but they all boil down to just two major conclusions, backed up by many, many facts. One conclusion is that Soviet military capabilities vastly exceed what we are being led to believe, both in terms of quantity and quality. The other conclusion is that the Soviet Union is firmly convinced that a nation can fight a nuclear war and continue afterward as a functioning society. And based on that conclusion, from a Soviet study undertaken after World War II, the Soviet Union has for more than 20 years been preparing militarily to fight and win a nuclear war. The American approach, on the other hand, is only to deter such a war, even though General Keegan says, quote, I am unaware of a single definitive effort ever conducted by the United States to determine precisely and in great detail what it would take to deter." Unquote. General Keegan also explains another very important principle. It has to do with official judgments of the strategic balance and carries over into public pronouncements by the Pentagon. "This is the tacit rule requiring the use of so-called agreed national intelligence," says General Keegan. Quote, "Agreed national intelligence is derived by committee. It contains little that is controversial, except in some footnote or dissent, and it rarely contains meaningful reference to the dynamics of strategic competition in terms of the new weapons, new forces, and new capabilities being evolved by the Soviet Union," unquote. Thus, whenever new threats are involved, whether it be the Olson particle beam weapon warned about by General Keegan, or the Soviet underwater missiles I've been warning about for nearly a year, Pentagon disclaimers dare not be accepted at face value today without challenge. Those who accept these denials are playing straight into the hands of our nation's deadliest enemies. Meanwhile, the build-up toward the start of Nuclear War I is gaining momentum. 2 months ago, Nelson Rockefeller visited Israel to help speed up the preparations for a Middle East war. By mid-April, Israeli troops had begun massive maneuvers in the Sinai with live ammunition. Reserves had been called up, and Egyptian maneuvers were soon underway as well in the western Sinai. These maneuvers, headline news in Europe and Britain, have gone unmentioned in the United States, except for the crash in the Sinai of a huge helicopter killing 56 Israeli soldiers. Then just a few days ago, the extremists came to power by way of the recent Israeli elections. The Middle East is now a powder keg as a result, and the Carter administration is rapidly disengaging and disassociating itself from Israel. So when the nuclear strike from the Sinai against Arab oil wells takes place, it will not be recognized by the world or by most Americans for what it really is. Perhaps General Keegan was also right about one other thing he said in his speech. Quote, "We have reached a point in America where I believe we are almost incapable, culturally, of being warned." Unquote. If so, my friends, it is we, the United States of America, who will have been weighed in the balances and found wanting like ancient Babylon.